Current time is now 7:28 p.m. here in Seoul, South Korea. It's time for Made in Korea. This with Professor John DeMoya from Seoul National University, who joins us live in the studio today. Professor DeMoya, hello to you.
Thanks very much for having me, as always.
Were you also up all night?
I was not, but I have to admit that much of yesterday, because we had a holiday with the, so the people had the opportunity to vote, that I was definitely around town kind of feeling the vibe.
There was certainly that vibe, right?
You could feel that things were interesting and going on.
Exactly. Well, we're going to be talking about maybe a background context to Korean electoral politics.
Yes, in many ways.
Right? Because we're going to be talking about, number one, who Kim Gu was and how he is regarded as a Korean nationalist leader. What was the Shanghai Provisional Government? How did it operate during the colonial period? And who was involved? And to what extent does this group play in a role in shaping the Korean state or states after 1945? It's an interesting situation we're looking at right now, prior to and during the colonial period, when Japan is in full control of Korea. What kind of political activities were possible at that time? I just feel like there must have been very limited political activity.
Sure. If we're talking prior to the colonial period or just leading into it, obviously, you have things like the Independence Club, the Tongmi Chunmun, people trying in late Joseon to push back against the perceptions of what was coming. As you just said, as you get into the early colonial period, famously, the first decade or so, 1910 to 1919, of the Japanese government general under Tarochi Masutake, the most strict form of rule, so-called military rule, so probably more restricted, certainly more consequences, prison, possible other things. So that in relation to what we're talking about, the activities have a tendency to either to go underground or to go above ground, but outside the nation in proximity, where you can kind of be in a place, as we'll talk, like Shanghai or possibly, you know, Manchuria in some cases, or possibly even Russia for some, and yet still be in close contact with people who are in the inside going on. So that the activity kind of decenters and surrounds the actual physical land of the nation.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously has to be done in a very secretive way. Being that
because you can no longer be open.
Exactly. But when we talk about sort of these political movements, independence movements moving forward, kind of going against the Japanese colonial rule, you always hear in the history books a gentleman by the name of Kim Gu.
Yes.
Let's do a bit of a history lesson on who Kim Gu is and the significance of this particular figure.
Sure. An absolutely fascinating figure, absolutely controversial for all kinds of interesting reasons. But just to do the quick take, his life span, interestingly, almost coincides with much of this history. Born 1876, Gangwon-do, not accidental, but nice kind of coincidence with Korean history. And will live until 1949, right after the division and the creation of the two Koreas. Also, just about any activity that happens from that period in the 1870s all the way up through the 40s, he participates in Tonghak. He is involved with the, in his own case, the direct killing of a Japanese national at some point in the 1890s. He's involved with all kinds of activity, sometimes failures, but planned assassinations of various Japanese leaders. And then, of course, like Isomon and a few others, he will return in 45 and be part of those last efforts to prevent the peninsula from being separated, so that almost any event you can name from late Joseon through the colonial period through the immediate post-colonial, he is there somehow. So last thing I'll say really quickly is that he, in the light of that, is now frequently named in North American and European programs for Korean studies. There are Kim Gu forums, Kim Gu chairs. So in a weird, interesting way, I think you already used the vocabulary. He is, for whatever people feel about him, he is recognized as being consistently nationalist and patriotic. It's that he was willing to go to extremes to do that, which is what makes him controversial.
And he's also helped many people follow the process of fighting, going against the Japanese rule.
Precisely.
And so when we say Kim Gu, we often call him Baekbeom Kim Gu. And yes. Back then, a lot of people use pen names. And,
yeah.
and it's kind of a way to secretly send messages and without having to review who they are and stuff like that. Because if, let's say, it gets intercepted and then Kim Gu's name is in there right off the bat, you know, they'll find out how to go about.
Definitely someone who is capable of assuming multiple forms and identities and moving around physically.
Exactly. Let's talk about what his activities were like in the late 19th century and the early 20th century.
Sure. Prior to the colonial period, I think the two things that he's most well known for, which both affirm his credentials as a nationalist but also make him controversial, are he does participate in Tonghak, late Chosun, peasant movements, resisting poverty, things like this, and trying to at least call attention to the Chosun government to these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then more famously, and this is the controversial one, in 1896, he is involved in the assassination of a Japanese national, Tsuchida Josuke. He claims that this individual was responsible for the killing of the Empress Myeongseong and Queen Min.
Mm.
The accounts that I've read are that is not, in fact, the correct individual. So that he kind of, if I understand correctly, he definitely kills this Japanese national and is seen as a patriotic gesture. But I think he probably identified or misidentified
the
party. Exactly. And this is the beginning of his long relationship to be willing to pursue certain courses of violence in the name and in the pursuit of political aims.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of been the long controversy, not so much here in Korea.
Yeah.
Right. But if you go overseas, and we talked about the assassination of Ito Hirobumi.
Yep.
Right. And, you know, the
and I believe he knew An. Yeah. I believe they knew each other in some context.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, we can argue that it was done with proper reason, considering the situation there. But it's how the other countries kind of view this. And there was no extreme for Baekbeom Kim Gu.
I think that's a fair statement. He wanted to keep the Korean nation at all costs as an integrated thing.
But I think here, generally, though, there is more positive connotation to Kim Gu rather than the controversial parts, although you did mention...
By here meaning South Korea?
South Korea.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. He is seen as a patriotic nationalist leader. Yeah.
Let's talk about what happened to K-politics after the March 1st, 1919 movement. We talked about the history of this. That particular movement really changed the minds of Koreans at the time. So what happened to K-politics after that movement?
I think with the provisional government, I think technically being formed not that long thereafter, that you can interpret the move as obviously the Japanese are going to crack down in the immediate, although later in the 20s, they will soften their rule.
Mm-hmm.
But when the immediate crackdown, the message is you better be careful about doing political things. And I think this is part of the decision to move to a place like Shanghai, which is in proximity to the Korean nation, under the Kuomintang, at least, I don't know, sympathetic, but certainly a place where you can go, be nearby, openly do political activity, and yet be safely at a remove from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, if people know the context for Shanghai at this time, the Bund, Shanghai being a little bit more of an international Chinese city, so probably also the ability to contact other parties and sort of interact at an international level, yet still be within very close contact and physical proximity to the Korean Peninsula.
I mean, because...
So you go overseas. Yeah,
yeah, so yeah. The establishment of the provisional government was April 11th, 1919,
yeah,
which is why we're talking about this, and the March 1st movement. So roughly about a month and 10 days after the March 1st independence movement.
Yeah.
But that provisional government was such a symbolic government because, again, being colonialized by Japan, there is no Korean government.
Right.
Right. And so to establish a provisional government, them saying that we are righteously a country, not, you know, governed or taken over, colonialized by Japan. However, unfortunately, the sadness of that is it has to be outside of Korea because of the crackdowns by the Japanese. Why? Let's talk about also why the group decided to set up base in Shanghai. You talked about the location,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But what is the most important factor into why they set it up in Shanghai?
Besides physical proximity, besides international, I would guess, again, I this is where I have to admit I'm kind of not an expert on this at all, but China at this time, Republican China, the Kuomintang, they won't, what's called the so-called the sort of the peaceful decade, 27 to 37. But not the, sorry, Republican government, it's no longer a Chinese emperor. It is certainly more open to, I imagine, talking to other kind of democratic forms. And as you just suggested, the provisional government's claim is essentially that we are a government or of a nation in exile. We are going to return when colonialism ends. We are pending, we can't physically be there because of the political circumstances, but nonetheless, we are ethically the rightful rulers. So again, I think proximity and access and things like this make it a kind of very appealing kind of site.
Who were the members and what kind of activities did they conduct with this provisional government? And also, were they able to maintain stability for much of the interwar years?
Sure. First, many of the same figures that you will see pop up all throughout the 20s and 30s. Lee Sung-man, although I believe he's not always there, but he's a prominent member. Kim Kyu-shik, who I believe is one of the people we talked earlier, who was sent to Paris in 1919, exactly. An Chung-ho. So a lot of the same prominent leaders that the names will pop up again all the way through the 40s. To your other questions, activities. All kinds of lobbying, Lee Sung-man probably more prominently to the Americans in D.C., talking to Republican China leaders. I imagine at some point later in the 30s and 40s, I would imagine some talking to the Russians, or at least, you know, trying to position themselves for when things ever change, when can we rightfully assume our power again. But then the stability, and this is where it gets more controversial, so I'll link it to what we know happens on the Korean Peninsula later. Everyone seems to agree that there is a Korean nation and they want to be in charge of it. There seems to be massive disagreement over the means to do that and which part of the political spectrum there is to do that. So that I think if anything, not to criticize, but they agree to disagree about many things, and they reflect some of the more chaotic aspects that will come when the return happens in 45. And it turns out that there are a huge number of parties all over the spectrum.
I mean, which is a kind of a litmus to what we see now.
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison.
We do see that
there is a very healthy democracy in both a good and a bad sense.
Exactly. I mean, but then you don't get that
itself. No, it's a good thing.
A sign of democracy, right? You're always going to have opposing ideas. You know, in any country, I can't say any country. In most countries, democratic society, you're going to have multiple parties with different ideas and so forth. I do wonder. We're not talking about 2024, where they could just simply kakao
what you're saying. Sure.
And communicate easily over the years. How are they able to stay in touch during the colonial period?
Sure. I would, and I hear I'm speculating a little bit, but I'm just guessing knowing the technology of the time and proximity. So proximity, I imagine sometimes you could have people come to visit and, you know, physically convey a message. But also at this time, letters, but as you suggested, with security, I imagine the letters under other names. And then also at this time, too, I don't know how the Japanese maintained security, but they definitely were famously a empire of telecommunications. So there have to be telegraph lines. So I imagine, again, under the careful, perhaps coded messages, perhaps messages in certain kinds of ways, but I imagine all three of those, communicating through individuals, communicating through physical letters, and then possibly through telegraph. And then those other two cases, letters and telegraph, probably coded, or ways of saying what you want to say, and then maybe ways of having another part of the message available to those who know how to read it a certain way.
Yeah, and then again, I mean, I mentioned earlier that a lot of the famous figures in history had pen names.
Yes.
And oftentimes, they were actually more known for their pen names rather than their actual names. And Paek Bum, Kim Gu is, Paek Bum is the pen name that we just talked about here. Would you say that they were able to increase or maybe change their activities during the 1940s? You know, 45 obviously is when you have a major change. What kind of preparations were made for the liberation of Korea?
Sure. One thing I've read is that the intensification of the war years, particularly even from the late 30s with the Japanese massive push in 37 into China, actually consolidates some of the political spectrum into a more singular, unified spectrum, in the sense that you are less likely to argue when you realize that you're facing sort of a very concerted foe. Mm-hmm. So some of that disagreement may be kind of quietly, you know, consolidates for a bit. And then there's also talk about with this consolidation, there's references to like a Korean military. I don't think they were actually conducting military operations, but at least they were promoting the idea that in some sense they were no longer just the provisional government, but that they actually represented perhaps in some sense the potential for an armed resistance on the outside. To your question, the one that always pops up is, of course, the famous Cairo Declaration at the end of 42 and 43, mm-hmm. The in due course line, which all Koreans know.
Right.
Apparently, they were not happy with this. They tried to communicate to the various parties, not knowing that the end of the war was coming.
They, who?
The members of the provisional government and the recipients to that would be like the participants in Cairo, which would be particularly to the Americans that they had the best contact with, telling them that in essence that in due course might perhaps need to be clarified. And Kim Gu has a line that's cited in a lot of the materials, and I think it's before 45, where he says something along the lines of, if there's any scenario where the war ends and we do not pretty much almost immediately receive independence, that's not good with me. And this is sort of anticipating the problems he's going to have with 45 and what ultimately becomes the division of the two Koreas. He is not happy about this at all.
So what happens then in 45, though, 1945? Because now we're starting to see significant changes, not just in Korea, but we can say in the world,
throughout
the world. There are major changes happening right now, big events happening. What happened in 1945?
The biggest, as we've discussed a little bit earlier, and then to link it up, is that with the U.S. arriving in September 45, the Soviets have already occupied the northern zone as of August. The Soviets in the U.S. late in 45, I believe November, December, will say, well, we're not sure, so this isn't going to be, we're going to call this a trusteeship. There are almost immediately anti-trustee demonstrations all over the peninsula. This begins some of the polarization process that will you can begin to feel the separation of North and South even a little bit there. But for someone like Kim Gu in particular, this is a point in time where he's not necessarily on board with what will become North Korea. In fact, mm-hmm. he was very much anti-communist.
Right.
But apparently he was willing to talk to Kim Il-sung and make some concessions precisely to avoid what he anticipated, which was coming, which was division. He favored... I'm not thrilled with the opposition, but I'm willing to talk to you over opposition. And this, he's kind of already anticipating what's coming. And
what's interesting is because for many years, he was known for his sort of extreme...
Yes, he's usually considered far right or extreme right.
Right. The fact that he was willing to talk to Kim Il-sung, but also... You mentioned a number of historical figures, Lee Seung-man, obviously, Kim Gu. You also mentioned An Chang-ho.
Yeah.
And... Once the U.S. comes into the picture here.
Yes, under the form of the American military government.
Right. Yeah. You're also going to see and potentially feel that the U.S. government is going to prefer maybe one person.
Yes. And we know who that is, but yes.
Over the other.
Yes, and yes. That will happen pretty quickly. Yeah.
And history shows that it is going to be Lee Seung-man.
Yeah.
But very quickly here, Kim Gu, his death.
Yeah.
Has long been...
Enormously controversial.
Controversial, too. Let's talk about what we know so far.
That's safe.
Yeah.
We know that in 1949, shortly after the division and the two countries have officially declared independence in 48, that he will be assassinated, killed, shot by a man named An Do-hee, where we don't know, but if I can just speculate, there's all kinds of questions about who was An Do-hee possibly working on behalf of. So if we know physically that An shot him, there are all kinds of rumors about he may or may not have been working on behalf of other political interests.
Yes.
Yeah.
And An Do-hee, his fate has not been met with... good stuff at the end as well,
because
he was also murdered, I believe,
yes.
by someone who believed that he was being controlled, and he was
precisely,
and he was a spy or something like that.
I
wish we had more time in regards to this. It is a fascinating development, and we can kind of see a precursor of what Korean politics was all about, but the significance of the provisional government in Shanghai. Professor Domoya, as always, thank you very much for your history lessons. Have a safe one. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.